Yeah, that's a question I've gotten a lot over the years, and everyone wants this magic grass that they can graze as hard as they want and manage however they want, and that grass is going to live forever and be productive. And not to disappoint anyone, but that grass doesn't exist.
Welcome to the 346th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Jeff Duchesne estimates he's helped set up rotational grazing plans in well over half of Minnesota's 87 counties over the past 17 years. That means, as a state grazing land specialist for the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, he's walked a lot of pastures and potential pastures ranging from the driftless region of southeastern Minnesota to the flat former prairies in the western part of the state. And he's yet to stumble upon that legendary forage that produces well no matter what the weather conditions, the quality of the soil, or how hard livestock hit it. But what's become clear to Jeff is that having the best grasses in the world doesn't matter without good management. In other words, there may not be magic grass, but there is magic management. And good management starts with developing a plan that takes into account a farmer's overall goals, the resources on hand, and even the market that's available for the livestock one hopes to raise on pasture. Fortunately for farmers and ranchers interested in jumping into or expanding a rotational grazing enterprise, there are more resources available than ever to help get them going. Besides NRCS grazing specialists and Soil and Water Conservation District service technicians who can provide firsthand advice, there are now rotational grazing funds available through climate mitigation and watershed improvement initiatives. Such NRCS programs like the Environmental Quality Incentives Program can use this funding to help livestock producers set up fencing and watering systems, as well as to seed down former crop ground and convert it to managed pasture. During a recent driftless grazing school LSP held at the Jordan and Rochelle Meyer Farm in southeastern Minnesota, Jeff led a pasture walk, during which he provided a tutorial on plant identification and ways to monitor pasture health. By the way, I'm sorry to report that no magic grass popped up during that session. Jeff also shared with grazing school participants information on some of the resources available for folks who want to either improve their usage of current pastures utilizing adaptive rotational grazing, or want to convert row-cropped acres to perennial forage systems that they can graze. At the end of the first day of the two-day school, I talked to Jeff about the increased interest he's seen in rotational grazing over the years, how it can serve as a gateway into farming for beginners, and key questions one needs to ask when considering setting up a grazing plan.
The trend seems to be increasing interest in grazing management, and it really started back probably even as early as 2010, 11, in that era when crop prices were high. What really started it was there was a lot of pasture that got plowed up. Well, the people that had livestock and still had pasture really needed to do a better job on the land they still had in pasture. So that was really the jumping off point for increased interest in grazing management. And it's just, ever since then, it just seems to have gotten more and more and more. Especially now with, as soil health has gained a popularity in regenerative agriculture, there's a lot of producers that are, it's just opened up a lot of management options, and there's a lot more, discussion on intensive rotations and cover crops and integrating livestock onto cropland, and it's really gotten a lot of producers, I think, just more interested in management with just all these the different options and different information coming out now about these management tools.
That's a really good point about the soil health thing, because I don't think that would have been, when you first started, maybe was the focus so much. I mean, people knew that it had these positive impacts on soil, but the soil health movement per se maybe wasn't the big thing that people were talking about.
No, that's right. 15 to 20 years ago, there was very little talk about that. And you look at a lot of the farm magazines, there wasn't hardly any articles about grazing in general. Now you look at them and they're just about every issue has at least something about about grazing management in there. Yeah, it really wasn't until kind of the late 2000s where you started to hear a little bit more about that, and now, you know, you hear a lot about it.
Some of the farmers I talked to who were early grazers, they were like, well, the incentive for me is it's a lower cost production system. If I'm a beginning farmer, the inputs aren't as, the infrastructure costs aren't as much, healthier cows, that kind of thing. But I didn't really hear about soil health being talked about so much. And like you said, that opens up a lot of opportunities, and that there's, seems like there's just more funding available, because you can say, oh, if you put in this grazing, particular grazing system, it's going to build soil health, and people are interested in building carbon, sequestering carbon, keeping runoff, you know, reducing water quality problems, that kind of thing. So it sounds like it does open up a lot of more opportunities that way.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, with the Inflation Reduction Act for NRCS anyway, we had an influx of funding for our programs like Environmental Quality Incentives Program. And, you know, and of course, one of the core practices, there's many, but one of the core practices is grazing management with that, prescribed grazing. Yeah, so I think that's really helped producers implement improved management.
It's kind of helped the environmental community kind of maybe take a different view of livestock on the land too, it sounds like.
You hear a lot of the negative side of livestock. You know, of course, there's a lot of buzz around methane and that, but there's also a lot of positives too that don't really get talked about a lot. You know, you think about, you know, there's a lot of producers I've worked with that have converted cropland into pasture. So that would have been row crop, or would still be row crop, if there weren't livestock on the farm. But not only the pasture side, the winter feed needs, they're growing a lot of perennial forage for hay. And without livestock, that would be gone. And so how are they going to manage that cropland? I mean, is it going to be conventional tillage and all that? Or, yeah, so I think just getting from a, environmental water quality standpoint, there really isn't anything better than having perennial vegetation on the landscape. So anything we can do to promote perennial vegetation, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, I've always seen grazing as, if you can make money at it, it's an incentive to have perennial plants on the landscape, and that should be, I mean, that's such a key piece of the ecology in the upper Midwest. Since we've wiped out the tall grass prairie, we need some kind of a perennial system. And if you just tell farmers to plant perennials and there's no economic incentive, you know, why should they do that? But this gives them that incentive to kind of go the perennial route.
Yeah, and with, you know, with a really well-managed pasture, there is economic opportunity there, I think. You know, just with, you know, if you do a good job managing your pasture, you can really grow a lot of forage. And I've always thought of grazing management as one of those kind of win-win situations. It can be really good for the environment and also be really good economically, just with, on the production side, just being able to grow more forage and be able to graze more days or carry a few more head, those types of things.
The other thing that strikes me, and this is a good example here with Jordan and Rochelle Meyer, it can help give beginning farmers or farmers who don't have a lot of resources access to land that's not considered top crop ground. Like, it's a way to add value to marginal farmland and maybe get it at a lower cost, or it's something nobody else wants to farm, or it's not farmable, it's too highly erosive, but value can be added to it through a good rotational grazing system.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, livestock are kind of a good gateway into farming, I think, because you can keep your input costs lower. You know, if you're going to start in row crop farming now, you have a lot of expense in equipment, where in livestock you can minimize those expenses and, like you said, just keep that land cost down. You know, and there's some creative ways there too. You know, like now with, obviously, we're getting a lot of solar farms in Minnesota, and I think they can provide a good opportunity for a beginning farmer to start out in small ruminants like sheep and be able to graze under solar panels. So I'm excited to see that, to see grazing on some of these solar fields now, and I hope that continues to expand in the future. And
I talked to three farmers today at the grain school who are doing that, grazing sheep under solar panels. So it's, when I see three things happen at the same event, I think it's a trend. So that's a really interesting one. Do you have a rough idea of what percentage of the grazing plans you help set up are these? This was already in some kind of a perennial system, either it was pasture or maybe it's even wooded country or whatever, and how much of it is this is crop gland. It was corn soybean ground that was converted to grass. They completely changed the system.
Land currently in perennial vegetation, I would say the vast majority of those operations have existing pasture. Now, a lot of that was farmed at one time and generally was really marginal, poor cropland, so it's been seeded back. You know, and that might have been decades ago it's been seeded back, or it could have been relatively recently. But a lot of farms, in addition to their existing perennial base, they're interested in maybe taking a few acres of cropland and adding into, you know, it might be a marginal edge of a field, or, you know, something that's kind of wet or highly erodible, you know, really steep, and they might need a few more acres of pasture anyway. So that's one thing we really work with them on, is bringing up some of those ideas. And a lot of times they're thinking about that already. But we have had, over the years, I've worked on a number of projects where they're just, maybe they're new to farming altogether, or they have a grain farm and they're looking to add livestock, so they're totally bringing on some perennial forage from scratch.
I would think that innovations in lightweight fencing, we saw some of those today, watering systems, now people are talking about, I know one guy that was here today, he's experimenting with GPS collars, the fenceless system. That must just, I mean, that just adds a whole another area of excitement around this, and it makes it so you're able to graze areas you weren't able to graze before, and makes it much more economically viable.
Yeah, the technology we have in fencing and water today is, I mean, it just gets better all the time. Better materials with permanent materials, or even temporary materials with like fencing and things like that, and even temporary water sources. That really makes it a lot easier to manage when you have good equipment. And now with the GPS collars on fence, I'm excited to see where that goes in the next 5 years. Seems like every year that technology is getting better and better and better. And yeah, so it'll be exciting to see the improvements that keep happening with that.
So if somebody approaches you about a grazing plan, what are some of the first questions you kind of guide them through about what they should be thinking about if they're setting something up?
Probably the number one item to think about is what your goals and objectives are. I mean, that's a big one. What are you trying to accomplish? Because that helps from a planning standpoint, helps, you know, kind of determine what your plan's going to be if you know what you want to do, like just overall management goals. That's a big one to think about. And the other side of that is also be realistic with expectations on, you know, where your farm's currently at productivity-wise and where it could get to with good management, and try to balance that stocking rate, really. You know, because if you're really overstocked, it's going to be hard to manage well. So kind of be thinking about those things too. The big one, though, is really thinking about the goals and objectives and where you want to go with it and what your context is.
Maybe rather than saying, I want to be a grazer, think about, why do I want to be a grazer? What is it that what am I going to get out of grazing that I wouldn't get out of a different system?
Yeah, I mean, what are your land management goals? What are your livestock production goals? Those are big factors that come into how you lay things out and how you're going to manage the pasture. And then just even beyond the land and the livestock, just your, you know, what's the right word, maybe worldview of things, or what your overall concept is. Are you wanting to manage organically? Are you wanting to be low input, manage regeneratively? I mean, you know, all those things come into play with how you're going to implement management.
I suppose also quality of life. Like, how much do you have a full-time town job? How much time do you have?
Yeah, that's a big one. And that's one thing I, you know, when we do staff training and things, I spend some time on. As an example, I've worked with some producers that, you know, they work on the road 5 to 6 days a week, and they may only be home 1 or 2 days. Well, moving every day or every few days isn't going to work for that operation. You know, okay, so we might set up a weekly move in that situation. That may be the best they can do within their situation, where, you know, the next person might be around, you know, their farming's their full-time job, and they're depending on the livestock for a significant amount of income. So they may have the ability to manage much more intensively. And, you know, labor resources are a big one, too. I mean, if you have to balance that out a little bit with how much time they have and how much they can devote compared to other things they have going on the farm, or even if they just work local in town. Yeah, I mean, that's some big considerations there.
So can you take us through what the Natural Resources Conservation Service, what resources they have available? They have grazing specialists like you, but they also have financial resources, like through the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, I know. You talk a little bit about some of what's kind of available and maybe what's available, too, through some other agencies or other groups?
So, of course, we help provide planning assistance, and we have several grazing specialists with NRCS, and we also have partnerships with a number of other organizations for grazing specialists. And so we have kind of grazing specialists that cover the entire state. So kind of start there, and once we get some plans put together, we have some funding sources. So EQIP, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, that's our main one for, you know, setting up a grazing system, installing fence, installing water, maybe, pasture seeding, those types of things. You know, if that's something you're interested in, you know, you can sign up at any time for that or receive assistance at any time, you know, just stop into your local office for that. So that's kind of our main program, and typically we have a sign-up deadline in the fall, usually. And then we also have Conservation Stewardship Program, which I kind of think of as maybe in an overly simplistic view. It's more of like a management program. You're already doing some things management-wise, but maybe you want to do a little bit more. So that program kind of takes into account what you're already doing, and maybe identify some areas where you could make some improvement from the conservation side, and then there's a whole list of activities you could choose from to try and address some of those that would fit your management. So that's another option we have. And other agencies, there's getting to be a lot more funding available just in general from a lot of other conservation agencies. So local soil and water conservation districts have been working on kind of watershed-based planning through One Watershed, One Plan. And so once they have those plans developed, they typically get implementation dollars to help fund conservation practices. And that may vary how that looks from watershed to watershed based on what the resource concerns are there, but that could be another good source to look at. And they also have state cost share that can help out with some things, and they may also do some other grants. So, your local soil and water conservation districts have some good funding opportunities now. Now through some of the climate smart commodities and opportunities through USDA, there's several organizations now that have funding coming available for conservation practices.
Well, and it seems like you could tie those in. Say you got some, a popular thing is to get cost share to put in cover cropping. So you put in a cover crop, even though that's an annual, but then if you then could get money through EQIP to set up a grazing system, you could graze that cover crop.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So there's a number of organizations providing some money for the cover crop planting, and EQIP could come in and help with fencing and water and things like that.
So this is an unfair question, but what's the craziest or what's the most challenging grazing plan you've ever set up? Can you think of anything that was just like, wow, I don't know if this is going to work, and then it ended up kind of working? Or
yeah, you know, we were talking a little bit about one today that was a challenge. We need to go uphill 135 feet with water, and so that was kind of a challenge getting water pushed uphill that far. Yeah. And make sure we have enough pressure to do that. And yeah, and that's a, you know, kind of a challenge in the southeast part of the state, but you know, generally we can figure a way out to do those things.
Yeah. Is it going back a little bit to the, if you're completely converting a corn soybean ground into grazing, that must be it must be a shock to the system almost. That must be a real challenge, is it, compared to if you're just trying to do some revamping of a existing pasture, that kind of thing. I mean, that must be, because there was a couple people here today who have, that's what they are seeding down, corn and soybean ground, and they're taking those first steps to trying to to actually eventually use it, make that into a perennial system?
Yeah, and it's very situational, site specific. You know, we've done several of those projects, and sometimes it works really well, and sometimes it's a bit of a struggle. And it kind of comes down to a couple of things. You know, if it's heavily eroded, that creates some challenges. More marginal land, you know, coarse textured soils, that can be a bit of a challenge. And then just, you know, depending upon what the herbicide program is, you know, sometimes that comes into play. Sometimes that's not too big of an issue. But we've had some seedings that really look good and the pasture comes on strong, and some other ones that leaves you scratching your head and trying to backtrack, like, okay, what happened here in past management? And the soil erosion, that's one where you walk in and there's been evidence of heavy past erosion. You kind of know are potentially more challenging.
Well, what you said, one question you get asked a lot is, what's that one magic grass that'll do everything I want? And you have a good answer to it.
Yeah, that's a question I've gotten a lot over the years. And everyone wants this magic grass that they can graze as hard as they want and manage however they want. And that grass is going to live forever and be productive. And not to disappoint anyone, but that grass doesn't exist. Yeah. The real silver bullet is management. You know, managing, if it's an existing pasture, trying to manage what you have to allow those forages to be more productive. And if you're seeding, converting cropland into pasture, really matching the species to the soils, and also matching to your management style and kind of what kind of animal performance you need out of those livestock. And that's really the big silver bullet there.
Yeah, there's no magic grass, but there is magic management in a way.
Yeah, exactly right.
So if somebody was just getting, and I assume there are grazing specialists in other states as well. Like, so what's the one place, should they just go to their local NRCS office, or what's the one stop shop where they can kind of get started in this process? Where would they start?
Yeah, I would stop into your local NRCS office. And they'll be able to, some of our local staff have good technical knowledge on grazing. And if they don't, they'll bring in other staff that do have that knowledge to help you out.
For more on building soil health profitably, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 346 at landstewardshipproject.org. There you also see links to NRCS grazing resources, as well as other podcasts in our 2024 Driftless Grazing School series. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.